Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. I welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our online and radio audiences. And it's my great pleasure to introduce Lawrence Schönbrunn, Larry, who is the lead lawyer in the case Lafitte versus Robert Half International. Before the Supreme Court of California a month ago or so, maybe 5-6 weeks ago. And he's here to report on why class action attorney's fees are so high and judicial oversight of those fees is so low. Larry.
Thank you. Is everyone hearing me okay? Yes, it's okay, good. I'd like to begin by thanking the Commonwealth Club for sponsoring this presentation on attorney's fees. I realize that this is not a sexy subject, and with the news cycle the way it is these days, there are certainly more exciting issues. And I therefore would like to thank each of you who've come to hear my presentation, as well as what I know is a very large podcast audience out there. So we can rest assured there's great interest over the internet. At the end of my presentation, I'm going to be happy to answer any questions that people have. At the outset, I'd like to explain why I feel this issue is so important to all Americans, although I understand it's under the radar. And it's under the radar because powerful interests are involved in these issues, and they want to keep it under the radar. Point number one I would make is, who's paying these fees? Although when you read in the newspapers, General Motors agrees to pay $25 million to settle class action, in reality, it's not General Motors per se that's settling it. It's all consumers who pay these settlements through the prices that are charged for goods and services that we as American consumers have to pay. So the direct cost to this is hidden in a way by the intermediary company. The second point is that I believe there's no greater example of the problem of the gap between the rich and the poor, the declining middle class, the 99% and the 1%, than these class action settlements, where too often, as one judge put it, class members get little pieces of paper and the lawyers get millions and tens of millions of dollars in attorney's fees. The third point as to why this is important, I believe, is that there's an enormous wealth transfer going on between these defendants and in the name of class members, but giving inordinate amounts of money to lawyers. And these lawyers are able to use this money to shape how our society is governed. And I say that in the context of contributions to politicians. And lawyers, as a group, are the second greatest contributor to politicians in our society. What kind of wealth are we talking about? I think George, someone I was talking to, mentioned this case. It was Enron, where the fee, just the fee, was $700 million. And fees of $300 million, $400 million are certainly not unheard of. And hundreds of millions of dollars in fees are, I would say, somewhat common. I read one statistic that talked specifically about securities class actions, and I don't remember the time frame, but the fees that were paid out of these cases amounted to $9 billion overall. That's just the fees that the plaintiff's lawyers are getting. When you talk about the fees that are given to the defendants, to the lawyers defending the defendant companies, if we're talking $3 to $5 million, so you've got, let's say, $14 billion. What does that represent? That represents the equity interest of shareholders, oftentimes working people, people who have, you know, pension plans and funds. And this is real money that's being taken away from these people and put into the pockets of lawyers. If you look at this in the context of hourly rates, which, by the way, it's considered, I don't know if the word is rude, but it's certainly, it's frowned upon to object to a class action settlement and talk about per hour how much lawyers are making. The tobacco case is an example. The hourly rate which the lawyers were, which the defendants agreed to pay the lawyers was $7,900 an hour. We're not talking about hundreds of hours. We're talking about thousands, tens of thousands, and even hundreds of thousands of dollars. Hundreds of thousands of hours. Now, the lawyers in that case weren't satisfied with $7,900 an hour, which was about $700 million. They sued because they, in essence, wanted to get 25% of the class's recovery, which would have amounted to $14,000 an hour. So this is the underbelly of what's going on in these cases that no one really knows about, and that the powers that be involved in these cases don't want anyone to know about. Now, in terms of these hourly rates, I've mentioned $14,000 an hour. We really don't know what these hourly rates are because the lawyers, this is an honor system. So a lawyer can put down whatever amount of hours they want. So for all, and of course they're encouraged to, the term is called pad their time. So I would say God only knows in reality how many thousands or tens of thousands of dollars an hour that they're taking out of these cases. Fourth point I would make about why this is important is the corrosive effect that this is having on the ethics of the legal profession, these enormous wealth transfers. And I would point out to you as an example the recent imprisonment. I think this is unheard of. Two lawyers, the most prominent lawyers, one named Larrack, the other named Weiss, I believe, were actually sent to prison for skullduggery in the class action industry. And what they were doing was they were the representative plaintiffs. They were getting representative plaintiffs to sue companies and arranging with these representative plaintiffs to give them a percentage of the fee that they were collecting in the case, so that the representative plaintiff, who under the law is supposed to look out for class members' interests, had in fact a conflicting interest, because the higher the fee the lawyers got, the higher the payment they got. Now,
very high-profile,
the most high-profile, the king of torts, he was called. Now, what happened was he claimed that this was a common practice in the industry. And although some tort reform organizations tried to get Congress to investigate whether or not this was true, the Congress refused to take the bait. The other thing is that, the last point is that these lawsuits, particularly the class actions, shape the way we live. Whether you're talking about warning labels on products or what size a bathroom is and what gender is going to use that bathroom, or whether when you're trying to get money out of a machine and you're being asked all these questions, do you agree with this? Do you agree with that? In all kinds of ways, these lawsuits are shaping our everyday life. The answer, I want to just say in a nutshell, to the question I posed, why are these fees so high and why is the oversight so low? In a simple way of stating it is that it is recognized in the class action law that the plaintiff's lawyers are entitled to ask for as much as they think the judge will afford them. The judge will authorize them. The judge will, how much money the judge would approve, and they are allowed, they're going to ask for the maximum. And unfortunately, in terms of the priorities of the judges, probably the last priority is how much money the class should get from these settlements. I mean, just to mention, major priority for judges is to get rid of cases. Judges aren't rewarded on the fairness and sagacity of an opinion they write or how they maximized the amount of money a client would get. Getting these cases out of the system is their highest priority. I'm going to be discussing the issues of fees in the context of the case that I brought to the California Supreme Court, Lafitte versus Robert Half. I just had oral argument about 2 months ago, and the decision is going to come out within this month, I believe. There were two issues in that case. One was the use of the percentage approach to calculate attorneys' fees. And not only that, but percentages used typically in individual traditional tort cases. In my case, although I believe there were 6,000 plaintiffs, the fee was 33 1/3% of the recovery, which is the same percentage that a lawyer handling one case would get. So in using Woody Allen logic, this is a case where the lawyers handle, let's see if I get this right, they handle the case wholesale but charge each client retail. The second point is, in the Lafitte case, is the lack of representation by the class when these fees are being sought. These are common fund cases. The defendant agrees to pay this fixed sum of money. And while the lawyers are trying to get this money from the defendant, they're trying to maximize the client's recovery. But once the case is settled, then they're seeking fees from their client's recovery and trying to maximize their fee, thereby minimizing their client's recovery, and the class has no representation. The fiction that's been created by the courts is that the judge is looking out for the class's interest. But to me, it's impossible that a judge, that any person, can be both a representative for the class, protecting its interest, at the same time, it's a neutral between the plaintiffs and defendants trying to arrive at a fee. So this system works in a way that the judge has a responsibility that's impossible for him to meet. I also want to say when we have some questions. I've appeared in over 150 class actions in this capacity, representing class members over the past 25 years. And I'm happy to talk about class actions generally or other aspects of attorney's fees. In Lafitte, there are only two issues, but there are a whole raft of attorney's fee issues in class actions that we could talk about. What has happened? It seems to me the two important things that have happened in the class action is that the jurisprudence has been turned upside down by the lawyers. When the common fund doctrine was established over 100 years ago, the courts permitted lawyers to take a fee from the class's recovery, but the court said you must do this with moderation and a jealous regard for the rights of those interested in the fund, the class members. The lawyers in the subsequent 100 years have turned that around so that there's no longer a focus on class members and how much they get. The focus has been shifted to how much money is necessary to incentivize lawyers to take these cases. It may be that by ritual, a judge will say, oh, we've got a responsibility to the class as an overarching statement. But in terms of the law, the focus now has turned from the class and class members to the lawyers and this talk about incentives. Now, are these incentives really an issue? I would direct your attention to the Volkswagen case, this recent case of the cheating on the computer so that there was more... on the emissions. Okay. So there have been 500 law firms filing suits in that case. I don't know how many of those are lawyers filing multiple suits. But remember, they haven't sued a whole industry in this case. They've sued one company, Volkswagen, and you have hundreds, and this is not unusual, to have 20, 30, 40 pages of names of plaintiffs' law firms who were involved in the litigation. And they want to focus on the issue of incentives and the need to take these cases to encourage lawyers, when in fact lawyers are falling over themselves to get involved in these cases because of how lucrative they are. The second way in which I believe things have been turned upside down is that the argument for the class action mechanism had been that, you know, companies are dishonest and they'll cheat individual consumers out of a dollar, but no one is going to hire a lawyer or get upset about a dollar. So it's a dollar to one consumer, but to a million consumers, it's $1 million to the lawyers. Sorry, $1 million to the defendant. So this class action mechanism, the idea was we'll put all these dollar claims together, and therefore we're going to stop companies from cheating consumers. So what the lawyers have done is they've now taken the place of the defendants. So now they're the ones who are taking an extra dollar or $10 from every class member in terms of their fee. But as the initial problem with class actions, that caused the need for class actions, the lawyers are now in the place of the defendants being sued, and no one has the ability to get back the money that the lawyers have taken. In talking about Lafitte, the reason the Supreme Court took the Lafitte case was that our California Supreme Court in 1977 issued this case called Serrano. And Serrano said that the starting point every time a court is calculating a fee must be based on work done. Who worked on the case? What did they do? What was their hourly rate? And in doing that, the California Supreme Court specifically said, specifically mentioned cases, federal cases, supporting that argument, which rejected percentages because they were overpaying lawyers. In the 1970s, that was a judicial concern, that lawyers are being overpaid. In the years since then, that no longer is a judicial concern. In my case, I cited numerous scholars who acknowledged that percentages give lawyers more money than if they were paid based upon the work that they did. The lawyers argue, we're doing great things for society. If we can get more money and spend less time suing this company, we have more time to sue another company, and that society will benefit from this. Now, I want to talk about the interests involved in these cases. First, of course, you have the plaintiff's lawyers who, more money and less work, that you can't beat that. So they want a percentage method. Then you have the defendants. Now, they're really not involved because once they take this money and agree to settle the case, they have no financial interest, ostensibly, in how this money is divided between the class and the lawyers. Unfortunately, it's arguably worse than that because if the plaintiff's lawyers get paid based on an hourly basis, they're encouraged to do more work. If they're encouraged to do more work, that means the defendant lawyers have to do more work. That means the fees to the defendants are going to be higher for the lawyers they have to retain. So in this circumstance, under the surface, both the plaintiff's lawyers and the defendants prefer a percentage, the judges. What the judges, of course, are very busy. The judges have no particular interest in, or skill in trying to analyze how much work these lawyers did, whether their hourly rates are fair, whether they haven't done things that didn't need to be done. They have no interest in doing that and no particular skill in doing that. So at best, the judges would prefer the easy way. It's very easy to take $100,000, multiply it by one-third, and that's the fee. A lot easier than looking at work done. Now, of course, the answer to that is that looking at the work that lawyers do is itself an industry now. Insurance companies, big companies who pay millions of dollars in attorney's fees don't just sign a check. They hire experts who look at these fees. These experts are available to the judiciary if they wanted them, but the judiciary isn't interested in this issue, unfortunately. Beyond the fact of the judges aren't particularly interested or skilled, I don't want to get into this too deeply, but there's a more sinister issue, and that concerns the judges themselves. There's a whole industry which has been written about very little called private judging. Thousands of judges throughout the country, oftentimes the best and the brightest, have left public service of being judges and are hiring themselves out privately, either as expert witnesses to come into court and tell a public judge, oh, this fee is reasonable, you should approve it, or as sort of literally judges deciding on the fee. And of course, the problem with that is that it's not merely the private judges who are affected. Any public judge, I would argue, who has an interest or aspiration to become a private judge later on, or to become an expert witness supporting a fee petition, is not going to cut lawyers' fees in his public capacity. Indeed, he's trying to ingratiate himself to these lawyers by approving the fee, so hopefully at a later time he will be hired. This is something that most people don't want to talk about. It's a total debasing, I would say, of the whole process of judging in our society that I think very few people know about. By the way, in my case, the fee that the lawyers were seeking was, I believe, for 4,000 hours of work, $1,500 an hour. Now, I'd like to talk about how oral argument went. We just had it about 2 weeks ago. I want to start by saying that
Can you tell us the basic facts of the case?
The basic facts of the case were that a company wasn't paying, I think, break time to employees because they hired. Yeah, they hired these people as in administrative capacity, not as sort of workers. In administrative capacity, they don't have to get breaks and this and that, but as workers, they were entitled to it. I think that's the general.
The class was all the people who were.
Yeah. Yes. So I think the first thing I want to say is, you know, I've been in 150 of these cases. I've done it, you know, throughout the country, federal courts, state courts. And for me, one of the questions was going to be, can it really be the case that I know what the superior courts do? I mean, you know, and they really don't care about the fees. The appellate courts don't really care either. What they want to do is just approve what the superior courts did. But I'd never appeared before the Supreme Court, and was myself, I felt it can't be that the Supreme Court can be that different in terms of the pressures and the interests than these other courts. And I think I found out that I was correct. I was hoping I wouldn't be. Now, my first issue was the fact that the class action mechanism has been created by the judiciary. It's not by statute, it's a judicial creation, and therefore the judiciary has a responsibility to make sure it's functioning properly and that the lawyers aren't being overpaid and that the class's interests are paramount. They mentioned that once in passing. The thing they were concerned about to an extensive degree, because they love kind of talking about incentives. What's the right incentive to get the lawyers to handle these cases? In terms of the significance of Serrano, which said you can't do it based on percentages, they just weren't going to accept that case. They said in the first place it was a footnote in the case without explaining why because it was a footnote that made a difference. They decided to apply it narrowly because the case in which the Supreme Court had said 30 years ago, in all cases in which a court is awarding a reasonable fee, it must be based on work. They, in essence, said all didn't mean all, and to the extent it meant all, it was dicta. So they basically were not going to accept what Serrano said. On the question of the class being unprotected, they did in their questioning acknowledge that. They kept asking the plaintiff's lawyer, who's protecting the class? You're asking for your fee. And he said, well, I'm protecting the class. And they said, well, how can you be taking money and reducing the class's recovery at the same time you're protecting the class? And he had some other kind of answer. But they had their own answer for this one, which wasn't briefed by anybody, but which I've heard before. They said, oh, the judges that handle class actions are very specialized, and they're very experienced. And because of those two factors, isn't it the case that they really can look out for the class members' interests? In spite of the fact that I introduced several authorities that said that the judges aren't doing that. They don't want to look through bills. They don't want to cut fees. It's not in the judiciary's interest to expose how the lawyers are taking advantage of the clients in these cases. It's just not what they want to do. But the judges, it seemed from the argument, weren't listening to those experts. On the question of isn't a third too much when you're talking about millions, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars in settlements, there's something called the lodestar cross-check. So they are questioning. You could see they were saying, well, we have a protection against that. We can sort of look at the time and the hourly rates. But what's happened is that it's been reverse engineered so that they figure out, you know, what's a third of $30 million, $10 million? How many hours does it take? And there's this thing called a multiplier. I don't want to get into it unless people are concerned about it. But they have a way of gerrymandering the lodestar so that they know what they want to get as the end result based on a percentage. And I was fighting that from the get-go because I know this is going on. And the reason they're allowed to get away with it is because they don't have to submit their time records. Any person in private practice, a client is not going to, if you say, oh, we want $6 million and we spent 4,000 hours on the case, that's not the way the real world works. In this case, that's what these lawyers did. They said there were three lawyers. By the way, none of them charged less than $500 an hour for anything that they did in the case. But one said, I worked 2,300 hours. Another said, I worked 1,700 hours. Another said, I worked 2,200 hours. And what the judges, and not just the one in my case, will say, 4,000 hours, this case lasted 4 years, and I know what went on. That's reasonable. So that's how they get around that one. A very interesting part of this, which I found shocking, really, was the plaintiff class action lawyers introduced amicus briefs, one by, I think, 12 law professors from throughout the United States, from Harvard, Yale, you know, Princeton, University of Chicago, Stanford, all these very prominent law schools. And their argument about why the courts should use the percentage approach was that lawyers cheated when they used the lodestar approach, or at least, as they put it, they were incentivized to cheat. They were incentivized to make up, inflate the number of hours of work, more lawyers than necessary to work on the case, spending more time than necessary on the case. So they were basically saying to the court, these lawyers are going to break the rules if you use the lodestar approach. The way to stop them from breaking the rules is to devise a fee system so that they won't have to break the rules to get even more money. And I will say that the court didn't mention the experts at all, but to me, even putting forth this argument to the Supreme Court by prominent law professors, I was astounded. And then another issue that came up, the problem is I'm one of the few people in the entire country who's doing this. And so there's no constituents. It's like fighting City Hall. There's no there are constituencies who are protecting the judge's interest, constituencies protecting the plaintiff's lawyers, special interests protecting the defendants. No one's there. The courtroom, the courtroom wasn't full of angry class members raising their fists saying, these fees are too high. And it's, no one's complaining. So the question was, who's up? All the federal courts use the percentage approach, which is true. Now, can you argue to the Supreme Court? Yes, the reason they're using this is because the plaintiff's lawyers get all these prominent law professors to come in and say, that's what you should do. So it's really the power of the plaintiff's class action bar and the fact that class members have little voice in this that's allowed this situation to occur. And I had the only ray of hope was that I made several suggestions to the court. If they were going to overturn the lodestar, that they should require the lawyers to submit time records. In fact, to tell you the tenor of the courts, this happened to me in a court of appeal. The lawyers in this case also, another case, not Lafitte, they claimed 14,000 hours that they had worked on the case, and they didn't say what they gave a general narrative. We did this, we did that, we did this, we did that, with no time, who did it, or how much time they spent doing it. And I said that you can't evaluate this time unless you see their time records. Then I cited Justice Brandeis, was it Brandeis? For the proposition that, the best sunlight is the best disinfectant, electric light. And as soon as the judge says to me, we don't want to hear about Justice Brandeis. tell us, blah, blah, blah. And then I felt I didn't do this with the Supreme Court enough, with this Court of Appeal, which got them very angry. But I felt, I said, look, you're condoning or encouraging lawyers to basically pad their fees if you're not going to make them submit their time records so that people can look at them. The public, you're awarding tens of millions of dollars in attorney's fees. You have an obligation to the public to have evidence. And, you know, that when I said that one, they said to the class action lawyers, you don't have to get up and argue. We've already decided this case, you know, you win. So, I mean, it's a two-edged sword. You want to try to encourage the court to think about higher ideals, but if you, but oftentimes they don't like it. So I think, you know, I think that's sort of, George, how long have we, oh, that's the end of my remarks. I thank you again for coming. I'm happy to answer any questions anybody has about what I feel I've done is that, you know, you can look at the water, looking at the water, you see the, you know, the blue whatever of the sea, but if you put on a pair of goggles and go underneath, there's a whole world underneath that ocean level. And I've tried to tell you about what's lurking below the surface.
Thank you very much. And I'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that they're listening to Lauren Schoenbrunn speak about why class action attorney fees are so high and judicial oversight is so low at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. So it's time for questions. Who would like to ask the first question?
Yes, hello. I'm a former general counsel of a multinational. So often I was, you know, outside counsel's worst enemy. I would scrutinize timesheets and say, you know, this should have only taken you 5 hours, not 7 hours. What are you charging me for? So I'm highly attuned to all this. And I will also say, but it always just sickens and revolts me. I own quite a not many shares, but I own lots of different stocks. So I'm always getting these incomprehensible 7-page notices. But somewhere buried in there, if you fly spec it, you will figure out that the lawyers are proposing that they be paid, you know, $120 million fee. And I usually throw them in the garbage and, you know, maybe eventually I get a check for $2 in the mail, that kind of thing. But one of them, I really went, you know, was just outrageous. I can't, maybe it was Enron or something, but it was a pretty high profile case. And so I went all the way. I went to the mat. I filled out the forms. I objected to the fees. You know, I sent it certified mail, et cetera, et cetera. And at least the plaintiff's lawyers had to respond to me as to why their $100 million fee was so reasonable. But in the end, the judge bought their explanation, which we've been discussing, and it got approved. And so I blame the judiciary. I mean, I think they're asleep at the switch and not doing their duty. Comments?
Well, it happens all the time. I mean, the statistics, there was a study done, I think, in 94% of the cases, the fee is approved as requested. And if the fee is reduced, it's nowhere near the reduction that is warranted based on the legitimacy of the work presented. It's for the reasons I've talked about, you know, that's the system, that's the way it works. And I used to say that this will change when there's a financial, I think I used the word disaster. Anyway, 2008 happened, and I was thinking maybe. And now I've changed it to financial catastrophe.
I thought the same thing with the recession. I thought that the lawyers' hourly rates would finally come down. But what they've done is they've stayed up and gone up, but then there's a lot of deals behind the scenes to discount them.
Yes.
Because everybody doesn't want to admit that there was a recession, you know, in legal fees.
Do you know of any studies that look at the entire societal cost, that attempt to quantify the societal cost of the class action mechanism?
Let me answer that by saying there are studies. What I would tell you is that the studies are done by entities allied with the defendants, which want to paint the worst picture, so that these studies have been criticized for that reason. And I don't think the studies have broken out class actions per se, but rather talked about it in the context of plaintiffs' tort lawyers generally. And I can't remember what the billion-dollar figure is, but it doesn't seem to affect the system.
It's another tax that's passed on, right?
Yes.
As you said at the beginning.
Yeah, what are your views on the Supreme Court's adoption of an endorsement of class action arbitration with class action waivers?
That's a very good question, because I will answer it this way. I think it's ridiculous to think that having individual people arbitrate their individual claims is in any way going to change the way defendants operate. And these defendants to me are, you know, as bad as the plaintiff's lawyers I've talked about. And I can tell you the cases, class actions I've been involved in where these defendants do things that are horrible. So that decision is, it's not a good decision. On the other hand, how many more people benefit? You know, these class actions, typically there are, you know, 100,000 class members and 7,000 class members file claims. Oftentimes, they won't disclose how many class members have filed claims. So it's not a good answer. The Supreme Court has been the only entity in the country that has tried to clamp down on these class actions. I don't know why. I think the class action lawyers are basically going to go to Congress and try to get that decision overturned through legislation, the kind of power they have. But the answer is it's not a good answer to this problem. But, you know, I would say the class action, as I think about it, it's kind of like communism in the sense that it sounds great. I'm going to put all these claims together. And, you know, it sounds great. It's just human nature being what it is and society being what it is. It's not a system that can be administered fairly. There are too many economic interests that exercise power to allow this class action system to function the way it should. And unfortunately, I would say the end result is that it used to be the argument companies would charge everyone a dollar more than they were entitled to and get $1 million. So now it's $1.75. The company charged a dollar. The lawyers get 75 cents. So overall, the consuming public is it's detrimental. It's costing them more now. They've got this elaborate system. They're being ripped off. Instead of a dollar, it's $1.75. So I don't think in the last analysis it's helping.
Well, thanks. Very interesting discussion. It seems to me, in your case, at least the plaintiff's class got most of the money. But what about coupon settlements, which I receive in the mail frequently, where I receive a notice that there's been an award for in which the lawyers receive $11 million, and I get a coupon for $100 off the next time I buy a Buick.
Right.
I mean, how can those be justified under any rational basis?
Well, I mean, I think they're justified this way, is they get the cases through the system. The judge can say there are a million class members. They're each getting a $50 coupon. It's worth $50 million. if we give the lawyers $10 million, that's only, whatever it is, 20%. So it's numbers that can be used that can allow the judge to say it's a $50 million settlement and allow the lawyers to say we're entitled to this percentage as a fee. And what I would say to you is that, and I was fooled too, the court system is not what we think it is. It's not, when you say, how can you justify? It's not about justifying a system through logic and fairness. It's not what it's about. It's about processing cases, getting them in, getting them out, getting the lawyers the fees they want so they'll stop suing, and then go on to the next case. So in the last analysis, it doesn't have to be justified or only superficially. No one's thinking very deeply about these issues. And they don't want to hear about it. I mean, I'll tell you something else, too. They don't want you coming into court saying why this system is corrupt, why these lawyers, they know that. And they don't want to hear you say it. So they'll say things like, Mr. Schonbrunn, what do you want to tell me that's not in your brief? I'm the only person who gets that treatment. And, you know, I won't go into all the other things that they do to try to shut you down. But it's a crazy system in a way. It's just run for the benefit of lawyers. That's what it amounts to. It's ostensibly in the name of the people, but it's run to benefit lawyers. So they don't need other than a superficial explanation.
What you're saying is a little bit like paying ransom to a kidnapper to stop the kidnapping from continuing.
Yes.
Not too much different than that. Oh, any other questions?
I'm just curious. I mean, one remedy against these lawyers that rip off their classes, which is what's happening, is to bring a separate class action against the lawyers. Has this been done, to your knowledge?
Well, if I can tell you, I mean, the answer is that the case wouldn't get, again, if you have to, what I would say to you is that, yes, it makes sense if you look at the court system a certain way, but if you look at the court system as where the judges and the plaintiff's lawyers and the defendant's lawyers are kind of in this together against the class members, they're not interested in exposing this system. It works for all of them. And the people it doesn't work for are society in general, but society in general is disorganized. So you wouldn't get very far you'd probably be brought up on some kind of charge for doing something wrong yourself. But I don't think that would help.
Well, the harm that people in the classes experience is merely window dressing for the whole process.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Precisely.
And I thought it was solving society's problems.
Well, the cure is worse than the disease.
Right.
And that's what happened. The solution is worse than the problem it was meant to rectify.
So the big solution for a big problem here is to not even try to solve the problem because it creates an even bigger problem.
Yeah. I would say again, it's people being what they are. This system is based on certain idealized notions of behavior that don't exist in the real world.
That's a great way to have one of the first programs on this series of big solutions for big problems. You know, sometimes the cure is worse than the disease, as you say, and it's a very good example of it. And thank you very much for coming and sharing that information.
My pleasure.
So ends another event in the Commonwealth Club's 114 years of enlightened discussion.